Okay, it's time for another GoldSeek.com Radio Gold Nugget segment. Today's special guest, David McIlvaney from McIlvaney Wealth. It's a pleasure to welcome back David McIlvaney, President and CEO of the McIlvaney Financial Company and Director of the Swiss Corporation Global Gold. Welcome back to the show, Mr. McIlvaney.
Good to be with you.
As we were discussing before the broadcast today, we were talking about the Fed governors. They cut their monthly bond buying stimulus, as expected, another $10 billion, and that's down to about $15 billion per month from a peak of $85 billion, I guess, last year. They're still holding rates near zero, and of course, this will have profound, you know, implications on the markets in the months to come and maybe even for years to come. So I know listeners would really like to find out your comments and your thoughts on just what these FOMC moves could mean for their portfolio's bottom line, please.
Well, we assume that the Fed can do what they say they can do, and that's, I think, the problem. You've got two things going on. Number one, as you mentioned, the mortgage-backed securities and the Treasury purchases, those being tapered to zero at the end of October. There is going to be a different reality. Can those markets take care of themselves without outside stimulus? And that has yet to be proven. So my suspicion is that just like QE1 and QE2, there was a boost in the marketplaces in the context of QE1 and QE2. And as they dwindled, so did the asset prices that were commensurate there. And so I think we will see a drop in the stock market. I think we will see some pressure in the real estate market and equities both. The other issue is rates and the balance sheet. And raising rates and decreasing the balance sheet, those are pipe dreams. Those are pipe dreams. So again, they talk about one thing. Do they actually have the power to do it? $17.76 trillion in debt. Interest payments on that will rise with an increase in interest rates. While the Fed may talk about doing that, when you talk with Congress, the question is going to be, fiscally, can we afford an increase of 1%, 1.5%, 2%? What's the threshold before bankruptcy? And yeah, I don't think the threshold's very high, frankly, because $17.76 trillion is a lot of money, 6% debt growth this year with not as strong GDP growth to match it.
I feel that it's a topic that's flown under the radar screen. You'll recall that the tops that come to mind, Moody's, Fitch, and S&P. Now, I find it fascinating that of the three, at least to my knowledge now, S&P is the only agency to significantly lower the rating on U.S. debt. And I suspect that's going to change in the years to come for precisely the reasons that you've laid out here, because folks have to start planning. What should investors be doing? What steps and contingencies can they be making now?
You know, frankly, I think owning gold is your contingency plan. It's insurance, as far as I'm concerned, in the idea that, again, just going back to the FOMC's own words, you know, they've basically said the Fed funds rate is going to be at 1.375 by the end of 2015 and 3.75 at the end of 2017, and they're going to use reverse repos as a part of their exit strategy. Say, can we afford the Fed funds rate at 3.75 with close to $18 trillion in debt, and we'll probably add at least another $500 billion next year? And the answer is a resounding no. So you can say whatever you want about the strategy that lies ahead. It's preposterous. And then to suggest that reverse repos are a part of an exit strategy, I'm just wondering if Janet Yellen even understands what a reverse repurchase agreement is. Because essentially what you do is you give an asset to a financial institution with the guarantee of buying back that asset at some point in the future. So you may have reduced your balance sheet with X exposure, but all you've done is substitute it with cash. That's the first issue. And the second issue is, just like a boomerang, that asset's coming right back to you, because the nature of a reverse repo is that you're going to buy it back. And so I'm just wondering about our leadership at the Fed. And I'm wondering if it's not any different than the types of decisions which were made by Greenspan and by Bernanke, supposedly solving problems when, in fact, what they were doing was laying the groundwork for the next major crisis. And I'm afraid that's what we have in front of us. So if you think there's the possibility that between government government bureaucrats, Fed officials, and our leading economists that something happens in the next 6 to 12 months, then I again go back to, don't you want some insurance? Which boils down to one thing. You want ounces? You want more ounces? You want as many ounces as possible.
They've juiced the system. They have not addressed the problems that got us into the last crisis. I think you'd probably agree back in 2007, 2008. In fact, they've just kind of painted over it. And unfortunately, the corrosion is now bursting through. And at some point, you know, the back of the vehicle might just crumble altogether. I mean, we are facing an even more frightening overall, at least, scenario in the economy. And for instance, as you pointed to, the housing market, you know, all they've done is really blown bubble 2.0. We have a mountain of debt that has not been addressed. And really, our top banks, financial institutions, are still carrying well in excess of $300 trillion of interest rate sensitive derivatives. So to me, it's an accident just, you know, looking for a piece of property to happen. What kind of timing are you putting on this? And that's a tricky question. You know, a lot of guests will shy away from it. I have a feeling that you have some parameters, a domain that you could put around this disaster that you see.
Well, sure. And I would suggest that for all the problems we've just described, one of the possible solutions is for us to grow our way out of it. We're not seeing real indications of that right now. In fact, the Rockefeller Institute just came out with a report showing for the most recent quarter, April to June of this year, personal income tax collections are declining sharply in nominal terms by 7%. And this is the first time since the fourth quarter of 2009 that state personal income tax revenue has declined for two consecutive quarters. We can grow our way out of it, but you're going to see an indication of that growth by, you know, an improvement in sort of people's bottom line. What are you bringing in an income? And if your income's not increasing, then I think you can assume that any growth we're seeing in the economy is not from sort of the nuts and bolts, healthy, sustainable, organic style of growth, but from leverage, added leverage, added debt to the system. And that is, in fact, what we're seeing happen. So, you know, I want to say, yes, there's great hope out there. On the other hand, we're going to have to see a lot more delivered for that hope to be realized. Time frame, I think 2015 to 2017 are going to represent something of a financial meat grinder. And in 2015 to 2017, I think investors need to ask themselves the question, to what degree do I intend to be grist in the mill? We've got the bond market, which is at an extreme level, both here and overseas, where people have been searching for yield and buying everything that wasn't nailed down in order to lock in their income needs, irrespective of the risk they were taking in terms of credit quality. You've got the stock market, which has more levered money in it than at any other time in world history. World history, okay? So if you're looking at margin debt as a percentage of GDP, in nominal terms, of course, it's much higher than it was in 1929. It's even higher than it was in 2000, 2007. At those peaks in the market, you've got more levered money in terms of margin debt today than you did then. But in all fairness, the economy's larger, the stock market's larger, and everything else. So as a percentage of GDP, it's north of 3%, which is the highest level in history. Where does this end? When does it end? To me, the margin numbers mean everything because the clock is already ticking. If we had $100 billion in margin debt, that'd be one thing. We've got over $460 billion in margin debt, which is clearly enough to get the enough of a snowball, if you will, to create a snowball effect and create a real avalanche of selling, of mass liquidations in the marketplace. Add to that the fact that you've got 60 to 80% of current volumes on the New York Stock Exchange coming from high frequency trading, which frankly could care less if they're long or short. And I think all of a sudden the avalanche becomes something of sort of historical proportion. So when does that come unglued? It's borrowed money. It has to be paid back. Whoever's in those equity positions is paying 6 to 8% for the privilege of using borrowed money to speculate in the stock market. Literally, the clock is ticking. Anytime between now and the end of 2017, I think you've got a doozy, worse than 1929 potentially.
We have virtually marginal participation in this equities rally. And that's something that I think that should be the wake-up call for most investors out there, that really John Q. Public, the middle class, they don't have much skin in this game. And as a result, when the money, when the margin gets scared, when the hot money says, you know what, it looks like the downside is the play here. Contingency plans must be put in place here. And as you said earlier, one of the best, if not the best, is the precious metals market. And if nothing else, maybe diversifying or increasing exposure in one's portfolio substantially to gold and silver and related equities is at least one method for protecting what they've built up. So what I'd like to address now, if you don't mind, is the precious metals equities. My guess is you have some interesting thoughts there. There's, I guess, two ways to really look at what's happened in the last few years. It's been a very trying period for most people involved. But you might also say, well, there's opportunity here. I mean, we're seeing discounted prices. What's your take on the precious metals equities, please?
A purchase of precious metals equities should come with a bottle of Pepto-Bismol. I mean, I think that goes without saying. So think pink when you're thinking gold or silver in that regard. What we see in the precious metals equities are levels relative to gold comparable to 2000, 2001. And so from a relative standpoint, they're very inexpensive. If gold lingers here at these levels for 2-3 years, you probably lose a quarter to a third of the field through bankruptcy. I'm not sure that it's going to linger that long because, again, when you look at the equities market is kind of your litmus test for how the general public thinks, you know, things are going. And on the one hand, you can look at Gallup polls, which show 70% of people unhappy with the current state of the economy. And on the other hand, if you ask them how things are going and if they can point to anything solid that's favorable, they'll say, well, but the stock market's doing okay. And on that basis, you see stocks high, gold low. There's really no reason to own it in this environment. But I would contest that and say the day the stock market rolls over, you're going to see people looking for safe havens. Treasuries may be a part of that. Dollars and cash may be a part of that. And I think gold and silver certainly will be as well. I have a hard time seeing that time clock go to sort of the critical 2-3 year period, which would cause, you know, a major winnowing of the field in the gold shares. Finding producers that have a low cost per ounce, you know, you want people who can stay in case we're wrong on the timing. So that I think is worth considering. I own them. I've added to positions in the last 2 weeks. If we see prices diminish further, I mean, as a company, we added to positions in December, in January, and were handsomely rewarded with some moves higher. And for shares that we owned at higher prices, of course, a recovery in value as we saw an increase from January to the mid-year. I think that's a little bit of a taste of what is to come. We may not be completely out of the woods yet, but I think for someone who takes a long view, not a trader's perspective, in it for a day, a week, a month, or even a year, but for someone who takes a long view and says, yeah, I think I like the direction of gold over the next 2-5 years, what you have with the miners is essentially a non-expiring call option on the price of gold. The problem with options is that time is against you, and you never know when the market's going to do what it's supposed to do. And if your timing's off, you lose everything. To own a miner is to own a non-expiring call option on the price of gold, and that's somewhat intriguing to me.
Well, you know, prediction, very tricky business, particularly when it regards the future, as it's been said. But I still would like to hear your thoughts regarding whether or not this could be the final move forward for equities. I'm not talking this week, this month, maybe even this year, but this primary push that we've seen, let's say from around 2009 until now, this 5-year equities rally, by some metrics, of course, one of the best rallies even since the 1920s, you could argue. The Dow is at an all-time, at least nominal, record high. The S&P 500 closing weekly record highs, maybe not today or this week, but in recent memory. So this is a unique time, and I don't think we've seen anything like this since the year 2000. Could this be a whole new, I don't know, inflationary paradigm shift, or could we be approaching a peak that our progeny will look back upon as the new 1929 market top?
Listen, I think the FOMC, they did not look at the Stock Traders Almanac for when they were winding down their quantitative easing 3 program. September and October historically are where you have significant crashes. You can look at a variety of periods and go back a long, long ways and see that. You had September 24th, 1869. You had the 1907 period, mid-October, after the Hepburn Act was put in place. You had 1929. You had, you know, the fall of 1987. You also have 2000 and 2007. I mean, over and over again, there's seasonal weakness. And the fact that they're pulling liquidity from the market in a period of seasonal weakness, I think, increases the probability that we are putting in a monumental peak here. Now, maybe they come out in 2015 with a new razzle-dazzle $5 trillion expansion of the balance sheet, double it from here. They can do that, and who knows what kind of rabbits they can pull out of the hat. We know that they can create trillions of dollars out of nothing. Maybe they can create rabbits ex nihilo as well. I think this is a terrible time to be pulling in their horns. Not that I liked what they were doing in the first place. I mean, frankly, I love Schumpeter's idea of creative destruction. I would have loved to see the 2008-2009 be a period where, you know, banks that didn't have any business being in business would be gone. So one of your questions about valuations and your comment, too, that 2000 was really the number to shoot for, because 2000 was the highest we've ever seen the stock market in terms of fundamental valuation metrics, far beyond 1929, far beyond 1987, even far beyond 2007. But 2014 is running neck and neck with those levels of highest valuation, the only period in U.S. financial history where the stock market has had higher valuations. If you're looking at price earnings or cyclically adjusted price earnings, yes, you've got to go to the year 2000. Now, maybe we're not to those levels, but we're marching ever closer. How close do you have to get to something that is objectively noted before you say again, here we are again?
These levels, these valuations are being cajoled by more than just hot money here in the United States. I mean, at least for quite some time, there was some flight away from Europe, not only due to the fact that they have a comparatively sluggish economy, but we also had the Ukraine-Russia drama, did we not? And that, of course, caused a lot of investors to scratch their heads, look around, where can we go? Well, we don't want to miss the party in the U.S. equities market. What do you think?
Yeah, it's fascinating to me that this era of investors is somewhat blind to various risks that need to be accommodated in a portfolio. You have inflation risk, you have deflation risk, you have volatility, you have liquidity risk, you have geopolitical risk, you have even domestic political risk, where policies can change and adversely impact a company or their program for growth. You've got uncertainty related to regulations and taxes. All of these things need to be present in an investor's mind. It's not sort of put your money down as you would in Vegas and roll the dice. There is actually a thoughtful process that goes into successful value investing. And in this environment, to ignore something as blatant as geopolitical risk, whether it's conflict in the Middle East, I mean, we're dropping bombs in the last couple of days, and no one really seems to care. Basically, put Russia in a very interesting and awkward position by bringing NATO forces to their doorstep. I mean, if you roll the clock back, if you look as a student of history and say, you know, what kept the French out of Russia? What kept the Germans out of Russia? It was this 1,000-mile barrier, land barrier, that we just shrunk by putting a U.S. oriented leadership in the Ukraine. Is it reasonable for them? Let's not even say reasonable. Can we understand why they would be agitated? Yes, we can understand why they would be agitated. All I'm saying is that the markets have not taken any of this into consideration, and it's as if central bank activity is the silver bullet and the cure-all for everything. As long as the ECB, the Bank of Japan, the Bank of England, and the Fed are willing to print like mad, there is nothing that can happen in the world which will disturb us, because we know the central bankers have our backs. And I'm telling you, this is very much like the prisoner's dilemma. The prisoner's dilemma is like when the players in a game, everyone knows they have to stay in for it to continue to work. but everyone also knows that they may want to be the person who gets out. Does this make sense? The system works as long as no one breaks from the system, but to avoid being in the system as it's breaking down, you have to be the first one to break out. What we're doing is the world of traders and professional money managers are all assuming that they are the guy who's going to get out. But everyone's still in. And everyone's still in because the central bank continues to promise the sun, moon, and stars. And when the Fed stops to promise the sun, moon, and stars, the ECB takes the baton and takes it a little bit further. This, to me, is one of the most perilous times of investing in certainly my lifetime. And our family's been doing this for several generations. I'd have to say risk is undervalued, underappreciated, and underinsured in a major, major way.
You started off the point with what I think is the most important key concept that I hope listeners take away from this discussion. This lack of understanding, even misconception, with regard to the components that we must have in a portfolio. And what's happened is we're victims of our own success. At least I think that's one aspect to this story. And what I mean by success is that, well, we've had this amazing contrived period that's been fomented by the FOMC, the ECB, and others around the world. And that has helped us to recover, of course, from the Great Recession. I mean, I don't even hear the term thrown around much anymore. Just a few years ago, we were all talking about it. Well, it seems to have been relegated to the past so quickly because of the liquidity and the rest of the measures that have been taken. Back on point, though, your family have been in this industry for so long, and so you would be well-versed in the understanding that a solid portfolio must be made up of much more than just the traditional stocks and bonds. I mean, you need international exposure, you need commodities, precious metals, so many components. Why don't I let you have the floor here to give people just maybe a basic overview of what they need to be considering now, other than just 5 or 10% precious metals weighting. Maybe that weighting should be higher.
And if we go too fast, our website has something that I think is particularly helpful. We call it our perspective triangle, and we go into an in-depth discussion of what that is. I'll give the brief version here, and for anyone interested, McIlvaney.com is a helpful resource on that particular issue. Look for the perspective triangle in the resources section. You're asking your assets to do certain things for you, and I think as you're diversifying a portfolio, you need to be very clear on what the mandates are that you're giving your assets. I talk about gold and silver as an insurance policy because that's the role they play in a portfolio. That, to us, is the basis. It's like the foundation of a portfolio. Now, beyond an insurance measure, which may replace lost purchasing power or compensate for market volatility in other assets that you own with an increase in value given the stress and strain in the stock market, bond market, real estate markets, what have you, that insurance component is very critical. You move to another category, what we would describe, again, by its mandate, liquidity. This could be cash. This could be cash equivalents. Why do you have it? Well, if there's an immediate opportunity that you can only take advantage of by writing a check, yes, you need instant liquidity. But what about managing a household or managing a business? Yes, you have to have adequate liquidity. If you don't have adequate liquidity, you can find yourself going from liquidity crisis to solvency crisis very quickly. So insurance is one thing you have to adequately address. Precious metals does that. Liquidity is another component that you have to address. Cash or cash equivalents addresses that. The growth elements are where Wall Street tends to hang their hats and say, listen, you've got some money and you want more. Well, that's pretty basic. That's pretty basic, and it appeals to sort of our instinct to greed. And so everyone gets slammed into a growth category by and large. And then as you get older, they moderate that somewhat and say, you also need some income. You know, listen, I think Warren Buffett's genius is not in being a value investor. His genius is in having a predictable and consistent income stream, which allows him to recharge and go play again and recharge and play again. So, you know, yes, you can wait around for growth, particularly when you get to average your cost down, knowing that you've got more income coming in that allows you to add to liquidity and, again, recharge your portfolio at a lower cost basis. So I think if you would look at all of his purchases of equities, you would find that Warren Buffett has actually done pretty well, in large part because he lowered his cost basis. He didn't always get it right. He didn't call it the right day, the perfect day, buying on the day that a particular equity traded at its lowest. But by focusing on income in tandem with growth, he was able to accomplish quite a bit. But again, liquidity and insurance next to growth and income, these are the mandates that the perspective triangle tries to, quote-unquote, add perspective to. And I would say in this environment, you could have as much as one-third of your liquid assets in precious metals. Now, one-third, I think, is more than adequate to accomplish, again, risk mitigation in terms of volatility of price in the general equities market, the bond market, the real estate market, and to compensate for loss in purchasing power in your cash equivalent liquidity position. So if you want more than a third, be my guest, but you're going to have that much more volatility, both up and down, and I don't think it's necessary. It's adequate as an insurance policy to max out at about a third.
David McIlvaney, we want to thank you for taking time for us today. Would you like to share any contact information for our listeners to direct their web browsers, the services that you provide, and any other contact information, please?
Well, thank you. McIlvaney.com is the easiest place to find us. That's M-C-A-L-V, as in Victor, A-N-Y. McIlvaney.com. Every Wednesday we do a market commentary. Certainly not to compete with yours. Yours is an excellent program. We listen to it, but it's very broad based. Politics, geopolitics, economics, finance. Try to cover quite a bit of ground in that 30 to 45 minutes of audio commentary each Wednesday, and you can subscribe for free at McIlvaney.com. Would encourage you to do that.
All right, David McIlvaney, we're going to look forward to having you back on GoldSeek.com radio.
Thank you, sir.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant cave KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.